Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Secretary Kerry and Foreign Minister Lavrov meet today to discuss Ukraine and how to defuse a crisis. And Election Day turns deadly in Turkey. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov meet today in Paris, trying for a diplomatic solution to the Ukraine crisis to reverse Russia's buildup of military forces surrounding Ukraine and with it the prospect of economic sanctions against Russia. U.S. officials who confirmed the talks did not give specific details. The new round of diplomacy is an effort to end what has, in a matter of weeks, become the most serious dispute between Russia and the U.S. since the Cold War. Kerry and Lavrov entered today's talks with what American University professor Keith Darden calls distinctly differing views on Ukraine.
So the Maidan, for us, was democratic mobilization. For the Russians, it's Western-sponsored regime change. And I think that gap is just going to be there. This is a fundamental difference in the way our two countries see the world. And that's not going away anytime soon.
There is more on the Ukraine crisis at voanews.com. Eight people were killed today in Election Day violence in Turkey. Voting was peaceful throughout most of Turkey, but feuds broke out in two villages near Turkey's southeastern border with Syria. Another 13 people were injured by gunfire. The balloting was largely seen as a referendum on Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who is battling a corruption scandal that has forced several of his ministers to resign. Arab citizens of Israel have observed an annual day of protest. Robert Berger reports from Israel.
Israeli Arabs held marches and rallies to mark Land Day. The event commemorates a mass demonstration against land confiscations in Galilee in 1976 when six Arab protesters were killed by Israeli security forces. Talal al-Karnawi is the mayor of Rahat, a Bedouin city in southern Israel. He said all schools, businesses, and government offices were closed in protest over the confiscation of land by the State of Israel and the destruction of homes that were built illegally. The Israeli government says the nation has come a long way toward easing discrimination and improving the plight of its Arab citizens. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
A series of attacks on security forces and civilians in Iraq killed more than 12 people today, a month before scheduled parliamentary elections. In the deadliest attack, gunmen shot and killed seven soldiers at a security checkpoint in the northern city of Mosul. In Ramadi, west of Baghdad, a suicide bomber detonated a vehicle on a main bridge, killing at least five people and wounding others. Part of the bridge fell into the Euphrates River. Australian authorities say a Navy warship with sophisticated U.S. black box technology heads out today to join the search for the missing Malaysia Airlines plane. It'll take several days for the Ocean Shield and its flight recorder detector to arrive at the location that the officials say the Boeing 777 went down in the Indian Ocean off the west coast of Australia. Meanwhile, dozens of angry Chinese relatives of missing passengers arrived in Kuala Lumpur today demanding more information about what happened to the aircraft and accusing Malaysian officials of withholding vital information. Malaysia's defense minister, Hishamuddin Hussein, has told the families that searchers are doing whatever it takes to find that plane.
We've got the latest P-8 Poseidons and the Orions out there. We've got a Chinese aircraft, the latest, never seen outside the world before, landing in Perth, 26 nations working together.
The search for Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 and the family's agony has gone on now 4 weeks. U.S. authorities say the number of people missing from a deadly mudslide in northwestern U.S. state of Washington has dropped from 90 to 30. Crews are looking for survivors in the debris of a mudslide north of Seattle, Washington. They stopped work on Saturday for a moment of silence for those killed in the disaster, which has shaken everyone living in the area.
This is a toll, has a toll on everybody. There's no one out here that hasn't been touched by, you know, the magnitude of what's going on.
Days of rain have made the search for possible survivors very difficult. Crews say the mud is like quicksand. The official death toll stands at 24. At 18, they have 24 bodies already, but they refuse to add another to the list until they can identify exactly who that victim is. I'm Marty Johnson, VOA News in Washington. There is more news and information, unfolding events covered on our website, voanews.com.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
And I'm Odette Frazier. Thanks for joining us.
How to prevent people from getting contaminated and really cope with the situation and control the epidemic that is taking place.
Guinea tries to contain the spread of the deadly Ebola virus after confirming 8 cases.
So the size of your farm determines the amount you get from waste. Because what I see, most of these local farmers, they do prefer the local waste compared to the fertilizer that government is giving to them.
Nigerian chicken farmers have figured out a way to make money out of chicken manure.
Unfortunately, there hasn't been that much information spread around the general public about the dangers of nuclear and certainly the costs of nuclear. So it's not just health, but we believe it will bankrupt this country.
And South Africa to boost nuclear power by adding more nuclear power plants. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa.
Guinea's Minister of Health says 8 cases of the Ebola virus have been confirmed in the capital Conakry. Aid organizations say the spread of Ebola to the city poses a new challenge for those trying to contain the outbreak. Jennifer Lazuta has more from VOA's West African Bureau in Dakar.
West Africa's first ever outbreak of the Ebola virus, which began in Guinea's southeastern forest region last month, is spreading. Guinea's Ministry of Health says 8 people have tested positive for the virus in Conakry. 1 person has died. The World Health Organization confirmed that there have been 8 suspected cases in Liberia, including 6 fatalities. In Sierra Leone, 6 people are believed to have contracted Ebola. 5 of them have died. This brings the total number of suspected cases to 125, including 81 deaths. Roland Berahudugu is the regional head of disaster risk management for the humanitarian organization Plan International. He spoke to VOA from Conakry.
As you know, Conakry is the biggest city of the country, and people are really a very crowded city. So the issue is how to prevent people from getting contaminated and really cope with the situation and control the epidemic at a specific place.
Nearly 2 million people currently call Conakry home. Many of them reside in slum areas where living conditions are poor. Throughout much of the city, there is a widespread lack of access to water and sanitation. Berahudugu said this could increase the speed with which the outbreak spreads. The Ebola virus, which is one of the most contagious viral diseases, is spread through contact with bodily fluids, such as sweat, blood, and saliva of an infected person or animal. There are no known vaccines or treatments available for Ebola. The only way to stop its spread is by preventing further infections. Last week, when the epidemic was still contained to Guinea's forest region, the government forbid the sale and consumption of bats and bat meat. Bats are believed to be a natural host of the Ebola virus and could be contributing to its spread. Berahudugu said that while this is an important prevention measure in rural areas, proper hygiene is the best way to control an outbreak in an urban center, such as Conakry.
In Conakry, the people here don't really eat a lot of white meat, so the animal to human is less serious issue, but it's human to human contamination. So as you know, the disease, the virus is in the human secretions, the body secretions. So having individual good hygiene will prevent people from transmitting the disease, also from getting it from others.
Aid organizations are now working with the government to educate Conakry's residents about proper hygiene measures, such as hand washing and food preparation, using local radio, TV, and text messages. On Friday, the Ministry of Health urged people to immediately report any suspected cases of Ebola and not to touch anyone, alive or dead, who is suspected of having the virus. Health centers in Conakry are now offering treatment for all suspected Ebola cases free of charge. Jennifer Lazuta for VOA News, Dakar.
Meanwhile, amidst the growing concerns about the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, Sierra Leone's chief medical officer, Dr. Brian Akagbo, has maintained that there are no confirmed cases of the Ebola virus in the country. He tells me that the government has taken proactive measures by first setting up a task force.
Upon hearing the rumor of a 14-year-old whose corpse was brought from Guinea to Sierra Leone, the government immediately set up a multinational national task force that brought health sector with the need to prepare for a possible outbreak and an emergency response. But notwithstanding that, district health management teams have also reactivated their emergency preparedness response committees. As I'm talking to you, they started meeting over the past 2 days to see how they can come up with emergency response plan, and at the same time, they started sensitizing communities on risk factors of Ebola and how to be able to protect themselves individually for them not to become infected.
Now, with the setting up of the task force, what have been the findings of this task force so far?
What we did as a ministry is go into the village where this 14-year-old was buried. In fact, he was in Guinea. He died in Guinea, and his corpse was transferred. What we did was to send surveillance teams to the village of Boidu in the eastern Sierra Leone, and we have already identified about 15 contacts who actually came into contact with this young man, and blood samples have been taken, and they are directly sent to a Lassa fever laboratory in Kenema district, where blood samples will be analyzed and know exactly whether the contacts indeed were infected from this individual.
I know you say that there is this task force that has been formed. In the event of an outbreak, how prepared is Sierra Leone to handle such cases?
When the task force is set up, first of all, the Ebola virus is very similar to Lassa fever virus that is endemic in Sierra Leone. We have an established laboratory in Kenema where cases of Lassa fever are managed, and also what we have done, we've identified specific health facilities where isolation wards are now prepared. And at the same time, we have asked our technical partners like WHO to provide personal protection equipment for us so that all centers to be established will have personal protection equipment. And also the task force we met and actually threw out to partners who will be very much willing to support.
You stated that the task force identified a number of people that came into contact with this one person that is confirmed dead. Now, are there any confirmed cases of Ebola virus in Sierra Leone?
We don't have any confirmed, neither is a rare case of Ebola in this country. The young man died in Guinea, in a village called Fangamadu in the Kwekeru district of Guinea, and his corpse was brought to Sierra Leone. So there is no case of Ebola identified as yet in Sierra Leone.
Sierra Leone's Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Brian Makagbo, I reached him from Freetown.
It's a major step forward in genetic engineering. Scientists have built a customized copy of an entire yeast chromosome. Experts say it may lead to a better understanding of how the thousands of genes contained in these packages of genetic material work together in everything from yeast to humans. And it may make it easier to make designer yeast, creating living factories that churn out everything from antibiotics to biofuels. VOA's Steve Baragona has the story.
Geneticist Jeff Buka says it started with a coffee shop conversation with a colleague.
I mentioned casually to him that, well, of course, we could make a yeast chromosome if we wanted to, but why on earth would we want to do that? And he practically, literally started jumping up and down with excitement when I told him that.
So Buka, the colleague, Srinivasan Chandrasekaran, and a third partner, Joel Bader, spent the next year discussing how they could engineer the chromosome to make it worth the enormous investment of time and money it would take. Working at Johns Hopkins University, they decided to create an artificial version of chromosome 3, one of the smallest of yeast's 16 chromosomes. It carries about 100 genes. Buka says scientists have studied it for years.
It is, in fact, the sentimental favorite of yeast geneticists.
Buka and his colleagues recreated their favorite chromosome, gene by gene, with synthetic chemical building blocks. They included molecular seams so they could cut the chromosome apart, take some genes out, add others, rearrange them, and stitch it back together in ways that would help them understand how different combinations of genes work together. And since yeast genes are a lot like ours, the research could lead to a better understanding of human genetics.
And perhaps most interesting of all, we think it will be useful for actually improving the strain under a certain condition of growth or production of some useful product.
Different strains of yeast are already used to produce antibiotics, anti-malarial drugs, vaccines, biofuels, and much more. The ability to custom tailor chromosomes could give the biotech industry a boost. And Buca says the same process his group used to build a new yeast chromosome could be used in plants and animals, and even humans as well. The work appears in the journal Science. Buca is now at New York University. He says they are all aware of the ethical issues their work could raise.
We have a card-carrying bioethicist who's part of our team, and we think a lot about these things. In fact, our whole field is infused with a passion for doing the right thing.
He says every member working on the project has to sign an agreement not to do what he calls bad things with it. Experts note that this is not the first time researchers have built a big chunk of genome from scratch. A group at the J. Craig Venter Institute synthesized an entire bacterial genome in 2008. That group was funded entirely with private money. Buca's group relied on a single, relatively small government grant. Virginia Tech professor Jean Pécou notes that undergraduate students did much of the actual work.
There is a lot of significance in terms of engaging students and using a research project like this as a training opportunity, but in terms of the kind of infrastructure, the kind of intensity and things like this that you need for a project like this, is it really something that is fundable through public sources, or is it something that's going to be more in the hands of commercial interests?
Pécou notes that Craig Venter also used private money to sequence the human genome faster than the publicly funded project. Meanwhile, researchers still have 15 more chromosomes to build in order to reach their goal of constructing an entirely custom-made yeast genome. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
The Nigerian government says it subsidizes the cost of fertilizer, but some farmers say they never see a discount, paying as much as $40 a bag. In the Niger Delta region, some chicken farmers are offering a solution. They say they're turning their waste into wealth by selling chicken manure for less than a few dollars a bag. Heather Murdoch has more for VOA from Abuja.
Alice Umukuru is a vegetable farmer in the oil-rich Niger Delta. Fertilizer, she says, is supposed to be for sale for about $16 at a government-subsidized price.
The flower drop is good for our crops. Because what it makes us, they use.
But subsidized fertilizer never makes it to her village, she says. Sometimes she can buy fertilizer that was purchased at a subsidized price in the village market from someone who bought it in the city. But the price is marked up, she says, and it is not always available. For a long time, Umukuru says, she could only harvest a half bucket of okra and a half bucket of tomatoes every 2 days. Now she harvests five times that much. Her secret is simple. She buys bags of chicken droppings from local poultry farms for sometimes as little as 30 cents a bag. Chicken farmers say they also benefit from the arrangement and sell for low prices to encourage vegetable farmers to come clean out the manure from their farms. Mathias Ojikovu is a poultry farmer in Delta State who has about 3,000 birds. He says he makes about $25 a month selling chicken droppings to local farmers. Larger farms, he says, can make as much as $100 a month.
So the size of your farm determines the amount you get from waste. Because what I see, most of these local farmers, they do prefer the local waste compared to the fertilizer that government is giving to them. Because why? There's no sufficient money to afford the government, so they come for the local ones.
But specialists say chicken manure to grow vegetables is trickier than using packaged fertilizer. For example, crops can burn if the manure is not composted long enough, says Oka Ogini Eboibi, a senior lecturer at Delta State Polytechnic.
The farmers need to be properly educated to know how to apply these fertilizers. Because when you get the farm droppings, in the raw state, it contains some acidity.
In 2012, the Nigerian government launched a program to expand the number of farmers who actually get the subsidized fertilizer, which was then 11%. The government now sends text messages to millions of farmers with vouchers and instructs them where to pick up their subsidized fertilizer, substantially reducing the amount of corruption in the system. Officials say 60% of farmers benefit from the subsidy program. But in Africa's most populated country, with more than 160 million people, there are still a lot of farmers searching for fertilizer and turning to the chickens for help. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
South Africa has made clear it intends to add several more nuclear power plants to its current energy mix. There are 21 other African countries thinking about pursuing a nuclear power. With more than 600 million Africans off the energy grid, nuclear power is being promoted as a clean and efficient answer. But as Peter Cox reports from Johannesburg for VOA, some activists worry about the cost, the environment, and potential security hazards.
Dominique Gilbert lives near the Pelindaba Nuclear Research Center. That is where, from the 1960s to the 1980s, the South African government developed atomic bombs before becoming the first country to ever voluntarily give up nuclear weapons. When she drives by the dam next to the facility, where uranium is still enriched, she sees men casting lines into the water and eating the fish they pull out.
People eating that fish haven't been stopped fishing there.
Gilbert is a founding member of the Coalition Against Nuclear Energy South Africa. She's worried that the South African government, facing a severe energy shortage, is rushing plans for more nuclear power without public awareness of the downside.
Unfortunately, there hasn't been that much information spread around the general public about the dangers of nuclear and certainly the costs of nuclear. So it's not just health, but we believe it will bankrupt this country. It's totally and utterly unaffordable.
South Africa currently has two nuclear reactors at its Coburg nuclear power station. The waste from those reactors is disposed at the Valpuits Radioactive Waste Disposal Facility. Gilbert says South Africa has done little to study the effects of nuclear energy on surrounding communities or to educate the public.
First of all is air releases, because people can't see radiation. They can't smell it. They can't touch it. But these particles are floating around all the time, and particularly during accidents. During routine operations, there are emissions all the time. Another aspect that worries us enormously is the river, because nuclear technologies and reactors and so forth are highly dependent on water. Pelindaba, for example, uses or releases what they term low-level radioactive waste by the thousands of liters into the Crocodile River.
While such concerns about radiation exposure have been around for decades globally, some experts believe that nuclear fuel actually poses fewer health risks than something like coal, on which South Africa is heavily dependent. Kelvin Kem is a nuclear physicist and chief executive of Nuclear Africa.
Of all the energy sources that there are, nuclear has shown itself to be the safest. And it's quite amazing how much of a public misperception there is about this, that there's been absolute scare tactics developed.
But the 2011 earthquake and tsunami in Japan damaged its Fukushima nuclear plant, resulting in the meltdown of three of its six reactors. The country is still battling to contain radiation leaks, and the impact has been felt globally. Activists say there is good reason to be scared. Kem disagrees.
At Fukushima, they call it a nuclear disaster. It was not a nuclear disaster. Not one single person was killed at Fukushima by radiation. Not one single person was injured at Fukushima by radiation. Not one bit of private property was harmed by radiation at Fukushima. Nothing. There was a general disaster from the tsunami and the earthquake, but there was no nuclear problem as such.
Perhaps not yet, but here in South Africa, some residents and workers near nuclear facilities at Pelindaba and Valpuits say they have unexplained health problems they blame on radiation. Fenki Mofiwa is with the environmental group Off the Ground Foundation.
People around the area in Kuberg, they have illnesses which even the doctor cannot explain to them what kind of illnesses that they are having. Because most of them, they always been into in and out the clinics around Valpuits. People who have lived there for quite a long time. Since the dam site has been proposed, their kids are no longer feel free to go barefooted. They have side effects, so it's a concern to this community.
He points to the devastating radiation impact that the 1986 Chernobyl meltdown had on residents in the then Soviet Union.
Our decision makers, they didn't consider and follow on other accidents which happens around the world. They just considered it another way, a source of producing energy, but not taking, going back, the accident which happened, like in Chernobyl. There's no one who can go there and leave. The environment is no longer good for a human being.
But perhaps the biggest concern about a nuclear-powered African continent is a lack of stability and security, leaving nuclear facilities more vulnerable to attack or, as Gilbert worries, theft of nuclear materials for weapons.
There's a lot of conflict and political tension in Africa, a lot of increasing terrorist activity in particularly North and Central Africa, crime syndicates operating.
Knox Mesombenzi, the managing director of the Nuclear Industry Association of South Africa, acknowledges it is a legitimate concern, but one that can be managed.
We basically have a choice between isolating certain communities because of their politics or bringing them on board to the international community where international bodies can actually monitor what they are doing. One of the conditions for having a nuclear program is that the watchdog called the IAEA has got to play its part. Irrespective of the politics, if there is a watchdog that is capable of making sure that that happens.
Gilbert isn't comforted by that idea. For her and Mofiwa, the way to avoid both nuclear proliferation and possible health and environmental issues is to invest in renewable energy sources. But in a State of the Nation address, South African President Jacob Zuma said the country will be moving forward with a project to give the country 9,600 megawatts of nuclear energy. Peter Cox for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Thanks, Peter. That was Peter Cox in Johannesburg, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. We're coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America right here in Washington.
Hello, I'm Kim Lewis.
And I'm Yehiyas Wuhib.
Together we host The Voice of America's informative program, Africa News Tonight.
We present a thorough summary of the day's events, featuring interviews with newsmakers in Africa and the world.
Also, Sunny Young drops in live with sports, and we have features on science, health, and business.
Tune in Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. Join me on Straight Talk Africa every Wednesday as we discuss topics of special interest to Africans, including politics, economic development, press freedom, health, social issues, and conflict resolution. Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 1730 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
We'll be right back.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa.
And yet to come up in the second half of the program, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital Lagos, music from African Collection for your listening pleasure and indeed relaxation.
And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
But right now it's time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that let's go straight to Lagos and join Segun on the dot at DMA.
Good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, March 30th. Let's kick off with African club football news. Defending champion and record 8-time winner Al Ahly of Egypt has been eliminated from the 2014 CAF Champions League. Al Ahly, which lost the first leg 1-0 in Tunis, crashed out after a shock 3-2 home loss to Ali Benghazi of Libya on Saturday night in the Egyptian capital, Cairo. The stunning result saw the Libyans seal their first ever place at the lucrative mini-league stage as they progressed 4-2 on aggregate. For their part, the Egyptians dropped down to the second-tier CAF Confederation Cup, missing out on a historic hat-trick of titles in Africa's Premier Continental Club Championship. The result marked a sad welcome for new Al Ahly chairman Mahmoud Tahir, who was elected on the eve of the game. Joining the Libyans in the mini-league stage are former champion TP Mazembe and AS Vita Club, both of the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Confederation Cup title holder CS Faxien of Tunisia. TP Mazembe won the return leg match 1-0 to draw 2-2 with Sivasspor of Ivory Coast, but advanced on the away goal rule. AS Vita Club lost the return leg 2-0, but still won 3-2 on aggregate over Kaizer Chiefs of South Africa. And CX Faxien beat Royal of Guinea 2-0 to advance 3-0 on aggregate. The remaining four qualifiers for the mini-league stage will emerge later today, Sunday. Let's remind our listeners that the overall losers from the second leg matches will drop into Africa's other club competition, the Confederation Cup, where they will engage in a two-leg playoff to reach the group phase of that competition. Turning to the CAF Confederation Cup, Bayelsa United of Nigeria, Dida Hassani El Jadidi of Morocco, and Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia are through to the third round, following second round return leg matches on Saturday. Bayelsa United won 2-0 at home to triumph 3-2 on aggregate over Haumine of Zimbabwe. El Jadidi also won at home 3-0 to beat AS Kigali of Rwanda 3-1 on aggregate, while Etoile du Sahel advanced 5-1 on aggregate after beating SuperSport United of South Africa 4-1 in the return leg. Let's now turn to the ongoing 2014 FIFA Under-17 Women's World Cup in Costa Rica. Ahead of tomorrow, Monday's semi-final matches, all the three African representatives in the tournament have been eliminated. Zambia crashed out in the group stage, while Ghana and Nigeria could not go beyond the quarterfinals. Nigeria lost 3-0 to Spain, while Ghana fought hard but still lost 4-3 on penalties to Italy after a 2-2 draw in regulation time. The results from the quarterfinal matches on Thursday mean that the African teams fared better at the last edition of the tournament in Azerbaijan, when Ghana finished in third place. Monday's semi-final of the 2014 competition will pitch Venezuela against Japan and Italy versus Spain. And from Zimbabwe comes the report that incumbent Football Association president Cuthbert Dube was re-elected into his second four-year term after an election held on Saturday. The election went into a second round of voting, pitting Dube and former Zimbabwe FA president Trevor Jewell after two other contestants, Leslie Gwindi and Nigel Moyati, had been eliminated. Dube polled 44 votes to Jewell's 14 in the runoff. Other elected members of the executive committee are Omega Sibanda, vice president, Tawengwa Hara, Bernard Guarada, John Firi, and Fungai Chihuri. In other news, Chelsea striker Samuel Eto'o is unlikely to recover in time from a hamstring injury to face Paris Saint-Germain next week in the first leg of the European Champions League quarterfinals. The Cameroon forward was injured last weekend during a 6-0 rout of Arsenal in the English Premier League. Chelsea manager Jose Mourinho said on Friday he does not think Eto'o will be fit for the game in Paris. Now to our weekly countdown to the kickoff of the 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil. It is now 74 days to the opening game, and the countdown continues. We start off with the sad news that a worker died on Saturday after falling at the construction site of the stadium that will host the World Cup opener in Sao Paulo. The tragedy marks the seventh death in accidents at World Cup venues in Brazil. Fabio Hamilton da Cruz, whose age was not disclosed, fell about 8 meters while helping install temporary seats at the Itaquero Stadium, according to his construction company. The worker, who sustained serious head injuries, was pronounced dead just before he was expected to undergo surgery. Brazil's sports minister, Aldo Rebelo, released a statement lamenting the death and saying officials were awaiting results from an investigation into what happened. FIFA Secretary General Jerome Volpe said on his Twitter account that he was deeply saddened by the tragic loss of a worker. About 20,000 temporary seats were being added to the new stadium to increase its capacity for the high-profile inaugural match between host Brazil and Croatia. Construction at Brazil stadiums have been plagued by delays, and three venues remain unfinished less than 3 months before the opener. The other two stadiums under construction are the Arena Pantanal in the city of Cuiabá and the Arena da Baixada in the southern city of Curitiba. Now, tickets for only 7 of the 64 World Cup matches remain available as FIFA's latest sales phase nears an end. With less than 5 days before the end of the sales period, more than 2.5 million tickets have been sold for football's premier events. FIFA says the World Cup in Brazil is the most successful tournament in terms of ticket requests. Most matches sold out quickly after tickets became available on March 12th. But a few group stage games are proving tougher to sell. The match between Greece and Ivory Coast in the northeastern city of Fortaleza is the least popular match so far, according to numbers on FIFA's ticketing website on Friday. Nigeria versus Bosnia and Russia versus South Korea, both in Cuiabá, also have tickets still available. Fans have until Tuesday to purchase tickets. The next sales phase opens on April 15th. FIFA said about 295,000 tickets have been sold in this phase. A total of 3.3 million tickets will be sold for the first World Cup in Brazil since 1950. Meanwhile, the official anthem for this year's World Cup will be performed by Santana, Wyclef, Avicii, and Alexander Pires at the closing ceremony on July 13th in Rio de Janeiro. FIFA and Sony Music Entertainment announced the plans on Friday. The official World Cup anthem is entitled "We Will Find a Way." In a statement, FIFA said this was the fourth piece of music added to the tournament's official music program. The tournament has an official song, a super song, and an official mascot song. Finally, Japan will play Costa Rica and Zambia in Florida, United States, in early June in its final warm-up matches before the World Cup. The team will play the games against Costa Rica on June 2nd and Zambia on June 6th at the Raymond James Stadium. Japan is in Group C in the World Cup finals with Colombia, Greece, and Ivory Coast. Costa Rica is in Group D with Italy, Uruguay, and England. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Douglas the Mighty Mpuga in Washington.
Thank you, Segun. Segun on the dot, Adeyemi will be back again next Sunday for another look at Africa Sports right here on Nightline Africa.
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time for music from the continent. Enjoy! Mm-hmm.
Kenya. Waka waka. L'homme de tous les dossiers, Ayamunde, Rafa.
And that was our Sunday music spot from Nightline Africa, here at the English service of the Voice of America.
Now let's take a closer look at Africa. One man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Take it away, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The much-awaited announcement by Field Marshal Abdul Fattah al-Sisi that he would contest the forthcoming elections in Egypt was finally made last week. The Field Marshal remarked that he would be resigning from the army he loved to stand for elections as a civilian in conformity with the Egyptian constitution, which requires that presidential candidates must be civilians. But this compliance did not satisfy those Egyptians who are worried that should the field marshal win the elections, then the Egyptian armed forces would be back in full force in Egypt. The much trumpeted massive demonstration in Tahrir Square for many months that drove President Mubarak from power has been widely interpreted as being the end of military rule in Egypt and the emergence of civilian rule. Indeed, following the democratic presidential elections in Egypt, a civilian, Mohamed Morsi, was elected the new president of Egypt. But we all know that following another massive public demonstration in Tahrir Square and other parts of the country, Field Marshal al-Sisi, claiming he had a mandate from the people, ousted President Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood. The removal of the first civilian president was met with hostile demonstrations by the Muslim Brotherhood that supported Mr. Morsi, and there were heavy human casualties. A new constitution was written and approved, and we are now moving towards a new presidential elections in Egypt. In many ways, many Egyptians are ambivalent about Field Marshal al-Sisi's candidature. They would certainly prefer a civilian president, but many have reached the realization that the present circumstances in Egypt could only be made stable by a military government. It is also clear to many that the most popular man in Egypt today is Field Marshal al-Sisi. That is the reason why even liberals who are wary of military rule are now willing to accept the election of al-Sisi. But there are others who are worried that after such overwhelming support for a change in Egypt, some call it revolution, that they would again be faced with another military man after Nasser al-Zayat, Mubarak, and now maybe al-Sisi. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood are not so sure that they would welcome another military leader. For them, President Morsi, though under military control, remains the only leader and the only civilian president. That is the reason why there is hardly any expectation that the Muslim Brotherhood should support Field Marshal al-Sisi. This turn of events in Egypt should warrant an agonizing reappraisal of what was widely acclaimed as the so-called Arab Spring. Was this just hype? Some commentators are even saying now that instead of an Arab Spring, we have an Arab Winter. Indeed, careful analysis of existing situations in Tunisia, Libya, and Egypt would support this assessment. The young people of Egypt, who were so optimistic and enthusiastic as they demonstrated at Tahrir Square, must be wondering what they have produced. The military are back in Egypt, and it appears with strong public support. Would the situation be better than under President Mubarak? Not for the Muslim Brotherhood, who are now far more restricted than they were under President Mubarak. Many now are relying on hope. Should an elected al-Sisi be willing to walk on liberal lines in governance of Egypt? Will the economy improve? And will he ensure the stability of Egypt that every Egyptian now wants? We will all have to wait and see. But what we do know now is the Field Marshal himself had already warned the Egyptian people that he could not make miracles. Thank you.
That was one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America.
Thanks for joining us tonight. I hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. I'm Douglas Mboga.
And hope you'll join us again on Saturday. I'm Odette Fraser. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The threat of nuclear terrorism is real and remains one of the greatest threats to global security. An act of nuclear terrorism would have grave repercussions around the world, including the potential for a dramatic loss of life, the spread of radiation, and damage to the international economy. The best way to prevent terrorists from acquiring a nuclear weapon is to prevent them from accessing the nuclear material needed to build one. To promote efforts to prevent nuclear terrorism, President Barack Obama convened the first Nuclear Security Summit in Washington in 2010. 47 countries from every region of the world committed to safeguard nuclear materials from loss or theft. Since then, the world has made substantial progress. Subsequent nuclear security summits were convened in Seoul in 2012 and The Hague in 2014. Individual countries have taken specific actions to secure nuclear materials in their countries and to prevent illicit trafficking and smuggling. Indeed, since President Obama's first major national security speech in Prague in 2009 on nuclear security, 12 countries have completely eliminated highly enriched uranium from within their borders, and 24 highly enriched uranium nuclear reactors in 14 countries were successfully converted to low enriched uranium fuel use or verified as shut down. In total, 27 countries have removed or disposed of nearly 3,000 kilograms of highly enriched uranium and separated plutonium. With its allies and partners, the United States will continue to work to put in place a sustainable global nuclear security architecture designed to reduce the threat of nuclear terrorism, including at the next Nuclear Security Summit to be held in the United States in 2016.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.